Good morning. It's time to read the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, November 13th, 2019. I'm Karen, and my partner at the microphone for the next hour is Judy. We're pleased to be with you. This broadcast is made possible through a partnership between the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. Here are today's headlines on the front page of the Globe Gazette. Warren tops in latest Iowa poll. Pete's Kitchen puts out call for support. And Country Thunder announces 2020 lineup. Our weather today is cloudy with a high of 29. And with the first story, here's Judy.
Thank you. Our first article is entitled, Pete's Kitchen Puts Out Call for Support. And accompanying this article is a nice colored photo of Pete's Kitchen with the street sign stating, the road is closed to through traffic. This article is written by Jared McNett for the Globe. Residents respond after construction slows business. Over the past several months, one thing residents of Mason City could expect to encounter is construction. Not only at the multi-purposes arena or the Talon housing complex, but also a spate of road in town. In late October, the city announced that it would be closing a portion of 6th Street Southwest for almost a month in total. But now that the segment stretching from South Jackson Avenue to South Monroe Avenue is shut down, it has complicated things for a Mason City establishment businesses. On Monday afternoon, Pete's Kitchen owners, Arlene and Pete Kuroff, posted on Facebook to ask patrons for increased support and to take the city to task for its rollout of the project. I have almost been shut down by city employees not coordinating repair projects in the past several times. Currently, they're doing it again, the post stated. I'm not a person to ask for assistance. Too proud. I am usually giving help. I am asking my customers to come to Pete's Kitchen and keep this Ma and Pa shop in business. Since Pete's Kitchen made the post, it's been shared more than 900 times on Facebook by loyal customers, fellow businesses such as the Suzy Q Cafe, and by the Mason City Police Scanner page, which offers an alternate route to the business. And according to Pete, that wide online support has materialized into a renewed physical presence. At around 1:30 p.m., he said that he had customers standing six deep in line to procure a homemade gyro or eclair from the 6th Street staple. I don't expect it like what it's been last night and this morning, Pete said. It makes me feel awesome, the support that I'm getting. I can't say how much it means to me. Which will be important going forward because past closures have closed Pete's Kitchen as much as $150 to $200 a day. This time, Pete said that he's been in contact with the city and that he was told things could open back up in a few weeks, if not in a month. In the initial press release from City Administrator Aaron Burnett, he said that the work was necessary to replace a segment of water main beneath the Union Pacific Railroad crossing. City Engineer Mark Ram said that as of last week, the task of preparing the site was ahead of expectations, and that the contractor performing the boring began as they were scheduled to on Monday, November 11th. That sort of temporary disruption to local business isn't unheard of. During the full swing of Highway 122 work this summer, local business owners and managers in close proximity felt an increased burden. Bruce Kittleson, who owns and operates the Hardee's at 515 South Delaware Avenue in Mason City, took to closing his storefront earlier than normal because of how the construction had altered the traffic around the establishment. Tom Abbas of Ford and Leonard said that repairs had caused a 20% decrease in business for the 82-year-old store. And just like the 6th Street construction, the 122 work is ongoing. Karen?
Thank you, Judy. Warren tops in latest Iowa poll. Sanders, Buttigieg, Biden follow. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is solidifying her lead as frontrunner in a large Democratic field of candidates competing in the Iowa caucuses. But a new Hawkeye poll finds that fewer than a third of registered voters are strongly committed to their first choice. Warren is the first choice of 23.1% of those responding to the poll conducted by the Hawkeye Poll Cooperative, comprised of University of Iowa faculty, graduate students, and undergraduate students in the political science and sociology departments. Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, and former Vice President Joe Biden rounded out the top tier as the first choice of 18.1%, 15.5%, and 15.3%, respectively. They were the only candidates with support in double digits. Nearly 13% did not know or refused to answer. The results indicate Warren is well positioned in Iowa, 12 weeks ahead of the February 3, 2020 caucuses, according to Frederick Bohemic, University of Iowa professor of political science, who serves as faculty advisor for the Hawkeye poll. A Monmouth University poll released Tuesday showed Buttigieg as the first choice of 22%, followed by Biden at 18%, Warren at 13%, and Sanders at 5%. It was conducted November 7 through 11. The Hawkeye poll found notable differences in support based on demographics. Warren was the first choice of 30.7% of women, compared to 12.3% of men. Sanders led among men with 24.3%, but was the first choice of 13.7% of women. Buttigieg ranked first with 17.8% of women and 12.1% of men, while Biden fared better with men, 16.5% to 14.5% among women. The poll also found that candidates have yet to lock in their support. Just 31.7% are strongly committed to their first choice, while 50.9% say they have narrowed the field to just a few candidates, and 17.1% say they don't know who they will back caucus night. Concerning electability, 65% said the most important characteristic is that a candidate's position agree with theirs. The ability to win the general election was most important to 30.2%. Warren leads among those who rated positions as most important with 29.9%. Among those who indicated that winning the general election was most important, Biden leads with 27.1%. The Hawkeye poll of 1,288 registered voters was conducted October 28th to November 19. It has a margin of error of 2.8%. Among the sample were 538 possible Democratic caucus goers, including 465 likely Democratic caucus goers. The margin of error was higher in the subgroups. The complete results are available at class.ui.ed/policy/research/Hawkeye poll. Judy?
Our next article is entitled Country Thunder Announces Its 2020 Lineup. This article is written by Ashley Stewart for the Globe. And accompanying this article is a small colored photo of the classic Southern rock legend, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, who will headline the Country Thunder Iowa June 12th through the 14th festival in Forest City. Country Thunder Music Festival is making its 2020 debut in Forest City with some of the biggest names in country music. The festival, which takes place June 12th through the 14th, will be headlined by classic Southern rock legends Lynyrd Skynyrd, supergroup Old Dominion, and rising star Kane Brown, event organizers announced on Tuesday at Friendship Hall in Forest City to the audience of nearly 30 people. In May, Country Thunder Music Festivals announced it was taking over Treetown, a country music festival based in Forest City since 2013, next year. The festival, now managed by Premier Global Production, or PGP, was moved from Memorial Day weekend to June in hopes of better weather. PGP operates five other Country Thunder festivals throughout the United States and Canada, including one in the Twin Lakes, Wisconsin, and another in Kissimmee, Florida. An all-star lineup, site improvements, and an updated format are some of the changes made by PGP ahead of this year's Iowa Festival. Iowa was an easy decision when it came time to expand our brand and the fan experience that we deliver throughout North America, said Troy Volhofer, Country Thunder Music Festival's CEO. The fans here are incredibly knowledgeable and supportive of the state's robust country music scene. We're extremely pleased to be part of that landscape, and we welcome fans from across the region to join this party in 2020. Old Dominion, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and Kane Brown will headline Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, respectively. Complete lineups for each day will be released in 2020. As part of its Last of the Street Survivors farewell tour, Lynyrd Skynyrd, a 2008 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, will be playing all the hits and fan favorites like Simple Man, Free Bird, Sweet Home Alabama, Saturday Night Special, and many more. The Jacksonville, Florida based band has sold nearly 30 million albums within the past 50 years. Old Dominion, a five-member country band, has become a constant on the country radio in recent years. Its self-titled third album debut at number one on the Billboard Country Albums chart earlier this month. Kane Brown, a Chattanooga, Tennessee native, has emerged as a bona fide superstar and headliner, including number one hits such as What Ifs, featuring Lorene Alaina, Heaven, Lucid, and Good As You. Other artists performing at the Country Thunder Iowa Festival include veteran superstars Big and Rich, Clay Walker, and Lone Star, Red Hot Ashley McBaird, Granger Smith, Gabby Barnett, Riley Green, Mitchell Tenpenny, Megan Patrick, and others. There's not a venue in the area, I don't think, that would even compare to this, even in Iowa. So welcome to Forest City, said Forest City Mayor Barney Reuters Tuesday during the Country Thunder's announcement. We look forward to it, and we're going to have a great time here. Information about tickets, camping, and all the extras is available at www.countrythunder.com. You can order tickets by phone, and that's 1-866-388-0007. Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, all at Country Thunder. Karen?
Clear Lake officially iced in. Official date is one day earlier than it was in 2018. And with this article, there is a gorgeous picture of the sun setting over Clear Lake. Clear Lake is iced over. That's what Adam Thies, Clear Lake Water Plant Superintendent, announced Tuesday on the city's Facebook page. I think it's great news that it's iced over this early, said Kevin Paul, who owns Clear Lake Bait and Tackle with Chris Scholl. This year's official iced-in date comes a day earlier than last year and 8 days later than November 4, 1991 record. The latest iced-in date was December 24, 2001. Iced-in is declared when employees of the water department observe no open water along the shoreline. There is 1/2 inch to 2 inches of ice on the lake, Clear Lake Bait and Tackle said on its Facebook page. Hopefully it holds, Paul said, noting the forecast temperatures for the upcoming week likely won't contribute much to ice thickness. According to the National Weather Service, temperatures in the next week range from the high 20s to the low 40s. Temperatures over the weekend hovered around freezing, but the wind chill values in recent days have been near zero. Paul said the ice usually isn't thick enough for fishing in North Iowa until after Thanksgiving. It's a good start to the season, but guys still need to think safety first, he said. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources recommends at least 4 inches of clear blue ice for fishing and a minimum of 5 to 6 inches for snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles. Ice conditions change constantly, and its thickness can vary across the lake. Individuals are encouraged to be especially careful on ice around submerged trees and emergent vegetation, which tends to be weaker. For ice conditions across Iowa, visit the www.iowagov website. Judy.
Mason City Middle School student to be suspended. This article is written by Grace Platnitsky. A Mason City School District student will be suspended for the remainder of the semester. The Mason City Community School District met in a special session on Monday evening to discuss the situation and what disciplinary measures should be meted out to the student. Superintendent David Verstig said they could not release what the student did, only that it was a seventh grade matter that warrants long-term suspension after a disciplinary hearing. During the suspension, the student will still be allowed resource and options provided by the district. The student must submit an application for readmission at the end of the suspension, which then must be approved by the recommendation to the school board prior to readmission. Karen?
Turning to our editorial page, Iowa's education spending should be on par with neighbor states. This is written by Steve Corbin, an emeritus professor of marketing at the University of Northern Iowa. His opinions do not reflect those of the University of Northern Iowa. Sir Walter Scott, a Scottish author and novelist from 1771 to 1832, was correct when he said, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." That phrase may apply to Walt Rogers' September 30th Des Moines Register op-ed entitled, "Claims Iowa Isn't Spending Enough on Education Don't Hold Water." Mr. Rogers, a former Republican legislator, is currently employed by the Tax Education Foundation of Iowa, founded by David Stanley, a Muscatine Republican who proudly declared his not-for-profit think tanks as Iowa's leading anti-tax group. The essence of Rogers' thought piece was Iowa's GOP-controlled policymakers have given public school districts sufficient money and they don't deserve a penny more. Taxpayers need to know that with Republicans taking dominion of the Capitol in 2011, their 1.7% average yearly increase in per pupil cost is the same as inflation. No real gain for school districts. I'm confident Iowa's 327 school board officials would testify their increased cost of insurance, buses, and utilities, to name a few, are typically about double the 1.7% general inflation rate. To balance the budget, schools have been forced to reduce staff and instructional programs for 8 consecutive years. Rogers correctly states educational expenditures take up 55% of the general fund. Alert to taxpayers. There's more to the state budget than the general fund. Education disbursements as a percentage of all state expenditures are 16.9%. The national average is 19.5%. Iowa's paltry investment in public education puts us behind Midwest states like North Dakota, Missouri, Minnesota, and Kansas. Iowa's $11,150 per pupil spending allocation ranks 27 nationwide. It's sobering to know Iowa's per pupil spending is superseded by West Virginia at $11,290 and followed closely by Louisiana at $11,038, awkward bedfellows. Iowa ranks 22nd nationally in teacher pay. There's good reason why neighboring states like Illinois, number 11, Minnesota, number 12, are recruiting in Iowa to steal our best teachers and teachers in training. Margaret Buckton, Iowa School Finance Information Services, succinctly concludes, "Public school districts can't balance the budget by paying teachers and staff less while asking them to work harder and expect to have the quality workforce necessary to prepare Iowa's future workforce for success." It's ironic, Rogers says. A better solution would be to find a more transparent and better way to spend existing dollars in education. While as a legislator, he supports a $240 million private education funding bill, where there's no transparency for private or homeschooled children's attendance record, nor their academic achievement. Iowa's fiscal year 2019 ended with $289.3 million surplus. To bring our school district's financial wherewithal somewhat up to par, Governor Reynolds should call a special session of the legislature and allocate, as a conservative minimum, $80 million of the surplus to Iowa's public schools, which would give districts an additional 2% to partially pay for the ever-increasing costs of property insurance, health care insurance, and utilities. Research is replete that an above inflation and cost of living investment in public education lowers high school dropout rates, lowers teen pregnancy rates, increases post-secondary skill training, increases socioeconomic growth, and increases community prosperity. Likewise, Likewise, inadequate educational funding produces high costs for society in terms of crime, health, economic growth, and for Iowa, a number 27 nationwide ranking. Don't be hoodwinked by deceiving anti-tax.
Don't be hoodwinked by deceiving anti-tax, anti-public education proponents. Iowa has the financial capability to do better, separate themselves from the likes of Kansas, Missouri, Minnesota, North Dakota, West Virginia, and Louisiana, to restore our number one in the nation status. Contact your legislators, the governor, and demand a special legislative session to increase public education funding, not with additional taxation, but with money that's already in the bank. That's the editorial by Steve Corbin. Now, I'm going to read another editorial. It's fairly long. It's entitled, Schiff is the Ken Starr of the Trump Impeachment. In the absence of an independent counsel or a special counsel, Schiff has put himself in the role of the person assembling the case against Trump. Even before his ill-advised mockery of President Trump's request for a favor from new Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam B. Schiff was seen by Republicans as blinded by bias against Trump. And now that Schiff is leading the initial phase of the House impeachment inquiry, he has become Exhibit A in the GOP argument that the whole thing is rigged. As if to confirm that suspicions, Schiff's committee has turned a portion of its website into a glossy political campaign-style presentation of the case against Trump titled, Read for Yourself, President Trump's Abuse of Power. It's accessible from the main page of the Intelligence Committee's website through the prominent link bearing the innocuous-sounding title, Impeachment Inquiry. The House of Representatives launched an impeachment inquiry to ascertain the full extent of the president's misconduct. And thanks to the testimony from dedicated nonpartisan public servants, we now have a much fuller picture of how President Trump abused the State Department and other levels of government for his own political gain, the page states in its introduction. Pursuant to House Resolution 660, we are now releasing transcripts of these witness interviews so that every American can see the facts and decide for themselves, is this conduct acceptable? The question featured in the bold face on the website may sound neutral, but the page is anything but. Instead, it highlights excerpts from the selected witnesses to paint a damning case against Trump. This is precisely why Republicans accuse at least as much, focus on at least as much of the process of the inquiry as the substance. But it's important to put what Schiff is doing in historical context, not because he's breaking with precedent, but because he's adapting past practice to the current legal reality. President Nixon's Saturday Night Massacre, which attempts to shut down the Watergate investigation in October of 1973 by having the Justice Department fire Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox, which prompted the top two DOJ officials to resign rather than carry out Nixon's order, helped persuade Congress to enact a law in 1978 creating a judicially appointed independent counsel to investigate allegations of presidential wrongdoing. Independent counsel Lawrence Welch subsequently probed the Iran-Contra scandal during the Reagan administration, and then independent counsel Kenneth W. Starr dug into the Watergate land fraud allegations against President Clinton. Starr's Whitewater investigation covered several years of produced nothing, but with the help of attorneys for Paula Jones, who sued Clinton for sexual harassment, Starr forced Clinton in August of 1998 to testify before a grand jury about the alleged White House affair with an intern named Monica Lewinsky. Clinton falsely denied having sexual relations with her, and within a few months, the House impeached him in a lame duck session. The Senate declined to convict him the following year. Congressional Republicans hated the Welch investigation. Congressional Democrats hated the Starr investigation. As a result, Congress let the independent counsel statute lapse in 1999. Since then, the primary responsibility for investigating the president has rested with the Justice Department. Most recently, the top DOJ official appointed special counsel Robert S. Mueller III to look into possible Russian collusion with the 2016 Trump campaign after Trump fired FBI Director James B. Comey, who had been leading the counterintelligence probe. Current Attorney General Bill Barr has shown no inclination to investigate the allegations that Trump leaned on Ukrainian officials to conduct investigations that would benefit Trump politically. In fact, the DOJ has already decreed that Trump's request in July 25th phone call with Zelensky did not violate the federal campaign finance laws against seeking donations from foreign sources. So in the absence of an independent counsel or a special counsel, Schiff has put himself in the role of the person assembling the case against Trump. That's why the dispositions were conducted in private sessions as grand jury testimony is done, making it hard for witnesses to coordinate their stories. Hello, Gordon Sondland. That's also why Trump isn't being given the chance to participate yet, although Republicans on the committees are constantly advancing the narratives Trump's lawyers would be advancing to defend the president. The public hearings that began this week will give Republicans more of the openness they sought, but Schiff is likely to remain in Kenneth W. Starr's mode. He's leading a three-committee effort to gather evidence about Trump's machinations on Ukraine. It will be up to the House Judiciary Committee to open the process to Trump's lawyers, who will challenge the evidence and try to put it into very different contexts. The Judiciary Committee will then decide whether to recommend articles of impeachment for the House to vote on. Notably, Starr laid out two special grounds for impeaching Clinton based on his conduct with Lewinsky and his efforts afterward to cover it up. If Starr's investigation of that episode is any guide, one can expect a report Schiff produces to be similarly pointed and conclusory. It's safe to bet, too, that Republicans with situational amnesia about Kenneth Starr will complain that the process was irredeemably tainted from the start. Karen?
Thank you, Judy. It's name-calling that really annoys us. Our third piece from the opinion page. My mother had a saying that she always trotted out whenever I was prone to gossip when I was younger, which was often. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. She'd tell me a not-so-subtle reminder that I shouldn't be gabbing about anyone else unless I am without flaw myself. I'm reminded of this every week or so when I get an email from a fan, in quotes, who feels compelled to share how eagerly he awaits the demise of the Globe Gazette. And this piece is written by Jackie Smith, the editor of the Globe Gazette. And that's my addition there. In those emails, I and others in the newsroom are given new and creative profanity-laced names, and we're told how absolutely worthless we are for XXXXX, parentheses, fill in the blank here with whatever story we neglected to put in the paper that week that the email writer wanted, end parentheses. When I got the first email from this person several months ago, I opted to take the high road and respond with an email that went something like this. Hi, Mr. X, parentheses, I'm not going to out this person, though I admit to be sorely tempted, end parentheses. Thanks so much for your feedback. I really appreciate when readers take time out of their busy days to drop me a line. The reason you'd like to see XXX is because XXX. Thanks again for your feedback. No response. Within 2 weeks, again on a Sunday, I received another nasty gram, starting with the same exclamation that the writer couldn't wait until we, quotes, finally died off like you should have long ago, and then launching into another triad about a story we should have run but didn't. This time, my response was shorter and more terse. Quotations, Mr. XXX, quotations, I understand your frustration, but I was wondering if you could perhaps tone down the insults and engage in a civil conversation with me about what you'd like to see improve in the Globe Gazette. When you're ready to do that, I'd be happy to engage. Incidentally, what local daily newspaper do you plan on reading when we die off? End quotation. No response. After that, more emails came, always on Sundays, and always a downer. My husband suggested last time that I respond by asking him to stop in as a way of challenging this person to say these horrible things to my face instead of taking the easy way out and writing an email. No response to that email either. Journalists are pretty thick-skinned individuals. We learn early on in our career that a big part of our job is getting information from people at some really inopportune times. Say when they're trying to rip off taxpayers and hide that fact, for example. Just recently, our sports reporter was out covering a football team who we've written about extensively this fall with zero negative feedback on our coverage. But when he approached the coach after the game, which the team lost, the coach told him to, quote, never, end quote, approach him again and that he'd never speak to the Globe Gazette. When the reporter asked for the reason, he got sworn at, so he came back to the office and wrote the exact same story he would have written had the coach talked to him. Without quotes, of course. My point is these, quote, negative naboos, end quote, don't really stop us from doing our job, and they don't consider the consequences of their actions. The coach isn't hurting us, he's hurting his players by not talking about them to the largest media outlet in North Iowa.
Moving into the obituaries, we have four this morning. Darlene, Lillian, Egina, Phyllis F. Murphy, Ardendale Magnuson, Shirley Mae Dusenberger. And our first obituary, Darlene Lillian Egina. She was born January 26, 1930, and died November 10, 2019. Darlene Lillian Egina, 89, of Rockford, went to be with her Lord and Savior on Sunday, November 10, 2019, from complications of stroke at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice Inpatient Unit in Mason City. A private family funeral service for Darlene will be held at 2 p.m. on Thursday, November 14th, at the Hauser Waltar Funeral Home in Charles City with Pastor Robert Orr from the Gospel Hall Assembly of Applington, Iowa, officiating. Burial will be at Riverside Cemetery in Rockford. Visitation will be at the Hauser Weishaar Funeral Home from 5 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, November 13th. She was born January 26, 1930, daughter of Lillian and Albert Hulbert of Rockford, Iowa. Darlene married Harm Egina Jr. in 1947 and farmed 2 miles north of Rockford, Iowa. Darlene was an avid flower gardener but loved farming with a lifelong dedication to her beloved farms. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Mercy One North Iowa Hospice at 232 2nd Street Northeast in Mason City. Hauser Weishaar Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. That's in Charles City. And the phone number there is 641-228-2323. Online condolences can be made and can be left on the tribute wall of the for the family at www.hauserfuneralfn.com. Karen?
Phyllis F. Murphy. Phyllis F. Murphy, 92, of Mason City, passed away Sunday, November 10, 2019, at Mayo Clinic Hospital, St. Mary's Campus in Rochester, Minnesota. A funeral service will be held on Tuesday, November 19, 2019, at 1:30 p.m. at First United Methodist Church, 119 South Georgia. A visitation will be held on Monday, November 18, 2019, at Major Erickson Funeral Home, 111 North Pennsylvania, from 5 to 7 p.m. Interment will be held at Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Humane Society of North Iowa, Music Man Square, First United Methodist Church, or the Kinney Pioneer Museum. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. Major Erickson Funeral Home and Crematory is in charge of arrangements.
Arden Dale Magnuson. Arden Dale Magnuson, 83, of Albert Lea, died on Thursday, November 7th, at the Good Shepherd Health Center. Visitation will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. on Friday, November 15th, at Major Erickson Funeral Home at 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue. A memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, November 16th, at Grace Lutheran Church, 302 East 4th Street in Hanlontown, Iowa. Interment will be held at the Brush Point Cemetery following the service. Memorials may be directed to the family of Arden Magnuson. Online condolences can be left for the family at www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. Arden Dale Magnuson was born in Hayfield, Iowa on January 17, 1936. to parents Alan and Martha Halverson Magnuson. Arden grew up in the Hanlontown area and attended Grace Lutheran Church, where he was baptized and confirmed. He attended Hanlontown High School and joined the United States Army following graduation. After his time in the Army, Arden worked at Decker's meatpacking plant, various construction work, and was a member of the Labor Temple. One of Arden's passions was farming, milking cows, and raising various animals outside of Plymouth, Iowa. Arden was a big fan of the Minnesota Vikings and the Twins, and he enjoyed following both teams. He had many hobbies in life, from playing cribbage, gardening, and spending time with family and friends, to going on daily 10-mile bike rides on his single-speed bike. He was very proud of the ribbons that he received from the Fribourn County Fair for various injuries. Arden will always be remembered for his love he had for his children, grandchildren, and creativity and ingenuity, especially for fixing up his home. Arrangements are with Major Erickson Funeral Home on Pennsylvania Avenue in Mason City. Karen?
Shirley May Beldhaus Duesenberg. Shirley May Duesenberg passed away peacefully at home on November 1, 2019. Shirley was born in Kanawha, Iowa on February 4, 1936 to Nicholas P. and Fanny Beldhaus. Shirley and her husband Don Duesenberg made their home in Clear Lake, Iowa for many years before retiring to Mesa, Arizona. She will be buried at the Mountain View Cemetery in Mesa, Arizona.
Moving into the sports section of the Globe Gazette, our lead article is entitled Osage Volleyball Team Ready for the State Opener. And accompanying this article are a couple of very nice colored photos. The first one is of the Osage celebrates its victory against Emmitsburg Tuesday during the regional championship in Garner. And you can see the girls with their hands raised cheering. The second picture is of Ellie Bobinette, who broke the Osage school single session record for assists by making her 1,000th against Charles City in October. The previous record had been 941 assists in a single session. This article is written by Shane Lance for the Globe Gazette. The Green Devils face the biggest test against Grundy Center. The postseason is a time when the best teams in the state finally have to match wits with top competition. Teams that have dominated the opposition all season can be made to look silly once they face a squad with a better outside hitter or a complete defense. For the Osage Green Devils, this week will be yet another big test in what has been a spectacular season. Following last week's regional championship victory over Emmitsburg, the Green Devils advanced to the state tournament, the lone area team to accomplish that feat this season. Osage 36-6 will open the postseason as the number 4 seed and will take on number 5 Grundy Center 32-8 in the opening round game. Grundy Center comes into match with a 3-match winning streak, the most recent one a 5-set victory over Underwood in the Class 2A Region 4 championship game. Junior Abby Hammond leads the Spartans with 312 kills on the season, while senior Emma Cratch leads an impressive 51 aces. The Green Devils have relied on their powerful hitters and spectacular setting to get them deep into the postseason. Junior setter Ellie Bobinette leads the state with a program record of 1,122 sets on the season. Junior Danielle Johnson had a team high of 439 kills, good for 24th in the state. The players credit first-year head coach Brian Tabert's new team culture as a big season for the team's success, a big reason for the team's success. Talbert spent two seasons as an assistant coach under Andy Olson and coached much of the team at the JV level. With his positive coaching style and familiarity with the players, the team has thrived. "It feels different," Johnson said earlier this season. "He has brought much of a positive attitude toward things. Our culture has been amazing. We're all so happy to be here, and we're all happy to play for Coach Talbert. It makes it so much fun on the court. We all have loved him. We all have loved him the last couple of years, so we're excited he was going to be in the head coach position." Talbert is a fairly calm presence on the sideline during the matches, but in big moments, like when Osage clinched a spot in the regional championship with a win over Lake Mills, he let loose with a holler or two. Though his coaching style has earned the admiration of his players, Talbert places the credit for this season solely at the feet of the girls. They've responded well with their play, Talbert said midway through the year. "They're very aggressive any time during the game, and they have fun out there, which is an important thing." Osage will play Grundy Center on Wednesday at 4 p.m. at the U.S. Cellular Center in Cedar Rapids. The winner will play again at 4 p.m. on Thursday for the spot in Friday's state finals. Karen?
Thank you, Judy. Mm-hmm. Iowa State's haul keeps on trucking. Cyclones freshman has nearly 600 yards rushing. Iowa State true freshman running back Breece Hall has proven that the first games weren't beginner's luck. Hall has rushed for 186 yards on 36 attempts combined over the last two games. He's also caught 10 passes for 75 yards. In total, Hall has rushed for 585 yards and 7 touchdowns on 99 carries. Almost all of that production has come in Iowa State's last four games, which begs the question why Iowa State coach Matt Campbell didn't play Hall sooner. "I know I've said this a lot, and I'll continue to say it. I'd rather play our players too late than too early," Campbell said. "My whole point in that is I've got too many guys in this program that have worked too hard, that have earned the right to get on the football field and play. When a younger player earns that right, I want to make sure he's ready to handle the opportunity at hand. When you look at our last couple of years, we've done a really good job of that, knowing when to play the guys. That allows those guys to take advantage of those opportunities. That's a credit to Breece. It's certainly a credit to our coaching staff, and he's done a great job handling it, and we haven't asked too much of him." What Campbell looks for in a young player is in his program that's showing flashes of whether or not he's able to excel in practices, games, and school. Boy, that's really hard for some of our sophomores and juniors, let alone a young man that just got on our campus, Campbell said. It takes a pretty special individual to even be in the running to get playing time. Obviously, a lot of credit goes to Breece. Iowa State defenders had three interceptions go right through their hands against Oklahoma. Two were potential pick sixes. "You've got to make the play," Campbell said. "Obviously, we were able to do that in the second half of the football game, which is what really turned the tide for us. The play Mike Rose and obviously Zach Peterson make are incredible. Lawrence is in a great spot, makes a great play on the ball, and we had a couple of opportunities in the first half, and we didn't make those, so I think that's just part of football. You've got to make those plays. Somebody has to make them. You either make them or you don't, and usually in close football games, it's those plays that you make out that don't make that you make the difference. I don't even think it's something you concern yourself with other than you just keep pounding away at the details and habits that it takes to be successful. You keep growing, and sooner or later, you're going to make those plays, especially when you get kids like ours that care, and it's really important to them. Safety Greg Eisworth played most of the game for the first time since Texas Tech. He had been nursing a shoulder injury, and while he didn't start against Oklahoma, he did play most of the game. Eisworth recorded 3 tackles and 3 pass breakups against the Sooners. Offensive lineman Colin Olson went down with an injury against Oklahoma, but he returned the next series, and the injury isn't anything that would prevent him from playing against Texas. While Olson was out, Colin Newell took his place. It was his first playing time since going down with an injury in Iowa State's first game against UNI. Judy?
Police ID man who fell from ISU Stadium onto fans below. This comes from Ames, Iowa. Authorities have released the name of the man who was injured in a fall from the upper level of the Iowa State's Jack Trice Stadium onto fans below. A university police report says 31-year-old Eric Ely hit 3 women in the lower level during the October 26th game against Oklahoma State. None of them suffered serious injuries, and Ely reported was briefly lost consciousness and suffered a concussion. He was taken to the Ames Hospital before being flown to Des Moines Hospital. The report says Ely jumped up during a big play and just went over the rail in the one moment, like the momentum carried him over. Witnesses told investigators that Ely did not appear to be intoxicated. Ely was declined to comment publicly. Police say no charges have been filed. And in just a couple seconds that we have left before closing, there are some area calendar for the scoreboard for some games. On Wednesday, in reference to volleyball, Osage versus Grundy Center at 4 p.m. That's a state tournament at Cedar Rapids. And in basketball, the Nyack women versus Iowa Western at 6 p.m. Nyack men versus Luther College at 8:30 p.m. on Wednesday. On Friday, football, St. Ansgar versus Grundy Center at 10 a.m., state semifinals, UNI Dome. West Hancock versus Woodbury Central at 1 p.m., state semifinals at the UNI Dorm. Karen, I think we should probably close.
Yes.
And that brings us to the end of the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for November 13th, Wednesday. Your readers have been Karen and Judy. This broadcast has come to you through a partnership between the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of IRIS or KCMR. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for today's reading of the Des Moines Register. You're listening to IRIS, your 24-hour radio reading service. Have a great day, everyone.